Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. jackandrea.com. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's going to be an exciting program. A little later in the hour, we're going to be learning about what it takes to be a great coach. But first, we're going to learn what it takes to have a great, long, happy marriage. And we're going to learn something about that from none other than Marlo Thomas and Phil Donahue, who are about to celebrate their 40th wedding anniversary. And they are celebrating by releasing a book called What Makes a Marriage Last? 40 celebrated couples share with us the secrets to a happy life. Marlo Thomas and Phil Donahue, as they will explain, have crisscrossed the country to speak with 40 celebrity couples and to talk with them about how they were able to build long-lasting happy marriages. The book is published by Harper One. Marlo Thomas and Phil Donahue, we welcome you to the Morning Show. The two of you are about to celebrate your 40th wedding anniversary. Congratulations. A lot of people who have had a long, successful marriage would decide to write a book on how to have a successful marriage, just drawing from their own experience. You clearly made a different decision to look at the stories of many other long-term married couples. What inspired you to do that?
Please, and without masks.
I think marriage, and one marriage doesn't tell the story anyway. It takes a lot of knowledge, a lot of wisdom, a lot of information to get to the truth. So by interviewing 40 different couples, we found out what makes a marriage work. It isn't how to make it work, but what is it? What is it that goes on that makes a marriage work? What are all the challenges? And every single couple, a different challenge, right, honey?
Really. And certainly, well, something we probably knew but doesn't really come to the forefront of the brain. There's no such thing as a marriage that has no alleys, that has no
challenges
or big drops, big. Everybody has to face something, and I think it's a healthy thing for newlyweds to at least know this, not dwell on it, but anticipate it, not be bored by it.
And not be scared by it. And that's something that couples that have been married 20, 30 years as well, when confronted with, for example, Kira Sedgwick and Kevin Bacon, they lost the 30 years of their savings to Bernie Madoff. And her stepfather was the one that got them into it. And he didn't blame her, and she didn't blame the stepfather. It was something they did. They thought it was a good idea. They were making money, and all of a sudden, they lost everything. It was very interesting to see that if they had played the blame game, they probably would have separated. But they didn't. They just confronted it and said, okay, you know what? We were stupid. We don't know anything about money. We're actors. What do we know? We made a mistake. Move on.
Right.
And I think that feeling that let's move on together, let's go through the fire together, is what has kept these marriages together with every kind of challenge. And no marriage gets by with only one challenge. There's many, many challenges through the years. You know, Michael J. Fox and Tracy Pollan, within 3 years of their marriage, he was diagnosed with a lifelong disease that would certainly challenge them and their family. And Jesse Jackson, during his marriage, had a child with another woman out of wedlock, and Jackie had to face that. Oh, honey, tell Greg what Jackie Jackson said.
Well, first of all, she refers to her husband as the Reverend. And when people ask her how many children she has, she said, well, I have five. The Reverend has six.
She's really a spitfire. But again, it's her humor. It's her willingness to be candid and face the truth. We didn't bring that up to her. She brought it up as a challenge of her marriage. It's just, you know, and many, much alcoholism and cocaine abuse. Jamie Lee Curtis dealt with that with her husband, Chris Guest.
And jealousy, and how draining that is.
Hmm. And also, Mark Consuelos, Kelly Ripa's husband, thought she was not telling him the truth. He was in Boston making a movie, and he asked her what she was doing that night in New York, and she said, "I'm cleaning the toilets." He hopped on a plane.
He thought that was very fishy.
Very fishy. So he hopped on a plane and went back to New York to try to catch her, and there she was, cleaning the toilets.
Right. He walked right past her looking for a tall, dark stranger standing behind a drapery. So, I mean, it's what jealousy can do to you if you let it.
And it's also the constant, you know, you're not the same people. And Judy Vioris, who's a wonderful writer, said, you know, no matter how hard you try, he's never going to become you, and you're never going to become him. Really have to face that and make the accommodations necessary for this other person who is completely different from you.
Right, exactly. That's such good advice. The whole book's packed with it, of course. I like Viola Davis's line that marriage isn't 50-50, it's 100-100, and I think that speaks to what you were talking about. President Carter and his wife Rosalynn are probably your most distinguished guests, 74 years married. They talk in their conversation with you about how difficult they had writing a book together, and here you are writing a book together. What has this experience been like for the two of you to embark on this project together?
I've learned more about Marla than I ever knew before. I mean, really, I've had a front row seat watching. If you're going to be quarantined, you could do worse than be locked up with Marla. She's fun to be with, and she's always does little things like, you know, popcorn for the movie that she wants to watch tonight. So, you know, and I'm looking for more news on cable TV.
That's what we fight about the most, is his watching the news all day. But I think what Greg was asking was, what was it like for us to work on a book together? And I think it was interesting. We never wanted to work on a project together. We were always afraid that we wouldn't get along because I'm kind of bossy and he's kind of bossy. So we thought, uh-oh, we're two type A personalities and we just never wanted to do it. And when we decided to do this book together, we decided to plunge right in. We figured after 40 years we probably could do it. And what we found interesting that I guess we hadn't really put together is that our styles are so different the way we approach a problem or an issue. He's very cool and very laid back, and I'm much more excitable and much more, you know, oh, we got to fix this, we got to do this. A perfect example of that is we was going to interview Elton John and David Furnish in Toronto. We traveled all over the country, actually, to do this book because we insisted on doing everybody in person. And a little bit before the interview with Elton John and David Furnish, the assistant told us we had a half hour. Well, I went into panic mode. I thought, oh, my God, a half hour. So I started making up questions. It would be rapid-fire questions. And Phil sat down and put the sports on, the news on television. And I said, what are you doing? We have to get organized here. And we're only going to have a half hour when we usually had two or 2.5 hours with people. And we never prepared questions, but this one I figured we better get rapid questions so we'll get everything in a half hour. And he said to me, oh, don't worry about it. He said, they're not going to stop after a half hour. Well, I thought he was crazy. So I got completely organized and ready, and we went up there, and we were there 2 hours. He's right. You know, he doesn't go into panic mode. I go into panic mode. But and in a way, that helps. I mean, if we both got excited, that wouldn't be any good.
Right.
And if we were both laid back, we wouldn't be prepared in case something happened. So the differences in our personalities were not a hindrance. They really worked.
Mm. And that's actually a theme that's very much throughout this book, how sometimes opposites attract, and it's sometimes the differences between us that make a marriage most work. A last quick question. Were people ever reluctant to share these kind of things with you, or were they eager and excited to be open about this part of their lives?
I think a little of both. They started out, you know, when we got the transcript back from our taping and we looked at the transcript, you could see there was a moment where the, everybody clicked in. You know, in the beginning.
At first, they really looked us over.
Yeah, they did.
You know, what's going on here? and we understood that.
Yeah.
But once we got started.
Then it got to be fun.
It did. And we looked up and we realized that we were there for at least 2 hours.
And the funny thing is Mr. Donahue here said to me before we started, he said, I'm not talking about our marriage. And I said, okay. But, of course, we did the whole time. Because when you sit down on a double date, two couples talking, it comes out. He was really floored when we would get back the transcripts. He said, oh, my God, I didn't realize I said that. So it was so friendly that it was. I really was like a double date.
Hmm. Well, the book, again, titled What Makes a Marriage Last, 40 Celebrated Couples Share With Us the Secrets to a Happy Life, is a delight start to finish. Marlo Thomas, Phil Donahue, thanks for giving the world this wonderful book, and happy 40th anniversary to you both.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
Best wishes. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And we have slightly mixed up our files. I apologize. What is airing today is what was originally scheduled for Monday's morning show. We will have Nan Calvert and Kevin Doyle from the DNR for you on Monday's morning show. Here is part two of today's program, again, with our apologies. And for the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about coaching, but not necessarily coaching only on the athletic field. Coaching is something that actually just about all of us do at certain points in our lives. And to be a coach in whatever capacity is a really important privilege and responsibility. And that is explored in a really interesting new book called Coach to Coach, an empowering story about how to be a great leader. It is written by Martin Rooney. And Martin Rooney has been coaching athletics at a very high level for many, many years. Himself, an outstanding world record-setting athlete of his own, and also the founder of Warriors in Training. And he has worked with athletes in all kinds of different sports, and also shared his coaching philosophy, if you will, with a wide range of organizations and companies. And in this new book, he also spells out much of what he thinks is essential to being an effective coach, whether you are a coach in an athletic arena or coaching in some other respect. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with him about his book, again titled Coach to Coach, an empowering story about how to be a great leader, published by Wiley. Martin Rooney, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Hey, my pleasure to be here, Greg. And that was about as thorough and awesome of a introduction where you've set the bar high, so I'm ready to rock.
Okay, glad to hear it. Thank you so much. Before we get into the book, I think it would be helpful if our listeners knew a little bit more about you beyond the biographical sketch that I just gave them. Explain how, from an early age, athletics has been such an important part of your life and the kind of things you have done both as an athlete and then as a coach.
Well, it's funny. A question I've received a lot lately after I wrote the book was, who is your best coach, or who was your best coach? And although I dedicate the book to my junior high and high school track coach who really discovered me, I really realize now, especially at this challenging time where we've been pushed into our homes, and as you mentioned, that everyone is a coach to someone else, my greatest coach was my mom. And she was actually a physical education teacher and high school coach. And I realize now that she instilled not just a love for sport, but also an attention to my nutrition and my sleep that still sticks with me today. And lucky, because I had her, I ended up being a highly ranked track and field athlete in high school. I also played hockey and soccer and football, but track was the sport for me for college. And I went on a scholarship, in particular for the javelin throw. And then when I went to the Medical University of South Carolina, in a weird twist of fate, because I was always still in shape, I made the U.S. bobsled team. and I got to represent the United States around the world, and it just it gave me such a passion for fitness. But what I realized was, and this is interesting, is the higher I aspired in athletics, it was almost as if the attention to coaching sometimes got less or it got worse. And then when I eventually became a coach, and yes, I've coached UFC champs and military organizations and hundreds of guys that have gone on to the NFL, and I coached with the Jets and the New York Giants for years, and I just realized there was a need and there wasn't a curriculum for how to be a great coach. And that's when I started presenting around the world about it. And so many people had said, you got to make this a book, that finally this book after 20 years has come true.
Very good. I like the line that with which you open your introduction when you say the world needs better coaches. And a line or two later, whether you believe it or not, you are a coach. I think this is an important point for us to make right off the bat, because otherwise I think people are going to be, most people listening to this interview are going to be kind of listening through the wrong lens, thinking that this is an admittedly interesting book, but about somebody else. It's about football coaches and track coaches and soccer coaches. And even if we're not a coach, we might be interested. But you're really talking about coaching itself in a much more comprehensive way, which can have absolutely nothing to do with the athletic field. Tell us how you are thinking about this term of coach.
Yeah, well, I would say, and you hit the nail on the head, and I think everybody, for maybe the first time in our global history, appreciates the concept that they are all coaches right now. Everyone has become a homeschool teacher to their kids. They've become a chef. They've become, you know, everybody's taken on all the hats that were often given to everybody else when you didn't have to stay inside your home. And I look at the word coach as one of the most honorable things that you can be called. But I also say that it's an identity. And what I hoped with the book is that everybody starts to identify with the fact that they are a coach. So if you're a husband or a wife, you're there and you're a coach for your spouse. If you're a parent, you're a coach for your kids. If you're a business owner, you coach your staff. If you're a teammate, you coach up your other teammates. So in some capacity, everybody and how the world works or how society works is through our ability to coach somebody else up to be better. And the interesting part about it is I reach the highest level in sport athletically and as a coach, and I never had one day of instruction about how to be a coach. I mean, I have three different degrees, never had one class on it. And that's when I realized there was a gaping hole that everybody, and I hope everybody appreciates it when they hear this, you are a coach, but you may not know how to do it. And my book is an offering. Hey, it's not the be-all, end-all, but the thousands of people that have read it around the world, I'm hearing back from them because they love the story versus it being a workbook, and they're just putting the ideas into action, and they're getting great results. So I couldn't be more proud of it, but absolutely, anybody listening, this isn't, oh, let me hear what this guy did as a coach. It's how can I be a better coach to my kids, to my family, to my community, and help more people.
Right, and you don't just mean, you know, for parents, for instance, it's not just how can I help my my little boy play basketball better or my little girl play softball better. It's every aspect of their life in which you might be engaged in this activity of coaching. Let's circle back just for a moment to your own life again, just because, again, I think for context, it will be helpful for our listeners to understand the kind of coaching that you have done over your life. And you have coached at a number of different levels, and you have done coaching in the sense of team sports, but you have also done plenty of coaching which has been in a sense more one-on-one coaching with athletes. Just give us a sense of kind of the wide scope of coaching experiences that you have had and what this journey has been like for you as a coach.
Wow. Well, one thing is you heard about two of the organizations that I helped create, and one of them is called the Parisi Speed School, and that's a global organization around the world. And we started that back in the 90s, and it was to actually get out. Sports performance isn't just you're either born fast or you're not, but that you can train to be faster, to be stronger, and girls can do it too. And we were the pioneers of that. So I cut my teeth not to the highest level athletes in the world, but to 6-year-olds and 11-year-olds and getting the message out that everybody could be a better athlete. They're not born, they're made. And that transitioned into training for Warriors, where I also then got the opportunity to train top UFC fighters. I was one of the first guys that ever did that, prepared UFC guys for combat before the UFC was even popular. And then that transitioned into NFL players and military organizations like the Army Rangers and Navy SEALs. But never forget, I was a high school football coach, and I'm the current high school track coach in our town. And I think maybe one of the best things that I can say for everybody listening to maybe gain their trust is I also have 4 daughters. And not only do I consider myself their coach, but my daughter, my oldest, has been a top-ranked heptathlete for her age in track and field. And why I say that is not to impress everybody, oh, my kid is good, but to impress everybody that I understand how hard it is to coach your own child, in particular a teenage daughter. So I don't think there's anyone in the coaching space that maybe has ranged across all levels, boys, girls, teams, individuals, as I have. And I have to say I've been lucky for the opportunity, but it's been a study in how to do it, and that the results, the fruits of that are all there in coach to coach.
Right. One of the things that we often hear about great athletes who go into coaching, and of course that is a very, very common trajectory, is that just because you're a great athlete doesn't necessarily mean you're a great coach, and particularly if you're a gifted athlete where things came to you fairly naturally and easily, that means you are likely to be very frustrated and maybe not have the first idea about how to work with athletes with more ordinary gifts or athletes who for one reason or another have certain issues that they have to overcome that you've never had to overcome yourself. I mean, in other words, being a great athlete does not just automatically and smoothly transition into you being a great coach. For you, what was this like? I mean, it sounds like you were a very gifted athlete yourself. In a sense, has that been an encumbrance, or in the early going, was it an encumbrance in terms of you being able to be an effective coach for a wide range of young athletes in your care?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, and it's kind of interesting because my friends and I, we will sometimes sit around and talk about it. And one question came up recently where we were exploring things, and this is a great one, Greg. If I were to say to you, name for me like one of the greatest athletes of all time that went on to be a great coach, you can't, it's not, the list is really small. So here's what we've concluded though. It doesn't mean that if you were a great athlete, you can't be a great coach, but it means that they are two different things. And being a great athlete doesn't guarantee that you would be a great coach. And obviously, hey, right now, a lot of people are watching Michael Jordan's show, right? And hey, he had challenges coaching up his own players when he was playing with them. But, yeah, he can't say to Scottie Pippen, just jump for the foul line and dunk it. That's how you do it. So that could have been tough for him. But ultimately, what are we saying here is that coaching is a definitive study in itself. Coaching is a profession, it's a vocation, but it's something you have to devote yourself to. Now, again, I was lucky. I was raised like Bill Belichick. Everybody, his name comes up so often when we talk about coaching. He was raised by one of the greatest football coaches that ever lived. So he was around coaching his whole life. Now, he was never a great athlete, but he understood coaching and what it took to be great there. So I always say it's a separate study, and you got to devote yourself to it, and that's what I did. And I'll say this, being a good athlete, I would say helped me because it gained respect with the athletes I trained. But in the beginning, I was a lousy coach. Like I didn't know how to coach. I didn't know the first thing. And I thought everybody would be motivated the way I was motivated, and I've really had to learn and discover over the last 25 years of coaching. And I'll say this, and I'm still getting better. I'm still always improving. So it is a lifelong pursuit. But to answer the original question, being a great athlete does not guarantee you're going to be a great coach, because they require two totally different things. And I'll be bold enough to say this. The greatest athletes in the world, you know, it almost contradicts me, but I said everybody can be a better athlete. But unfortunately, the greatest athletes in the world are born as much as they are made. So if Michael Jordan was 5 foot tall, he's not Michael Jordan. Whereas Michael Jordan could have been 5 feet tall and been one of the greatest coaches of all time if he devoted himself to that.
I want to just jump in here to say that you're talking to somebody who in their professional life is primarily a music teacher, actually a voice teacher, and I've taught a little bit of piano as well. And what we're talking about just now reminds me of the challenge that I have faced over the years as a voice teacher and music teacher in general, and that is that a lot of things that came very easily for me as a naturally gifted musician has made it trickier for me to be an effective teacher, because as someone who can kind of sit down and play just about anything without even looking at the music and so on, it's really hard for me to put myself into the shoes of somebody who sits down at the piano and just does not feel that kind of natural affinity for it. And likewise, someone who's, as a singer, is dealing with different issues that were never my own personal issues. I've had to learn a lot over the years, and I am so much better at it now than I was in the early going, when I kind of blithely assumed that because I was a good singer and a good pianist, that would mean I would be a good voice teacher and a good piano instructor. And it's just not true. They're very closely related, but they're not the same thing at all.
Yeah, not only do I agree, but you're going to love this, Greg. So my third daughter plays piano, and my oldest, the heptathlete that I talked about, the other thing that we take great pride in is she loves acting. So she's been the lead in the last three school plays. And so can I appreciate the work that has gone into both of those and how much work she has put in? She puts in, and this is a shout-out to teachers out there, hey, musicians, my daughter has put in way more time in terms of vocally and preparing for plays than she does for athletics. There are so many similarities there in the amount you have to practice and how you have to study. But this is what I'm getting at. We had to look around for the right coach. Right. And that we found a great piano teacher for my daughter who's so patient and so great and makes her enjoy it. But her music/voice/theater teacher, she just loves that guy. And that's been the secret, that this guy gets everybody so into it that is what, you know, is the big thing about coaching, is he's so excited about them and he's so excited about music. He gets everybody else excited too. So I think it was that's another perfect idea there, that guys, it's not the sports field or just music or a play. That's the skill everybody needs. Like that's what my mom did for me when I was young, and it didn't matter. She got me excited about eating right. You know, that's totally different too. But now I look back and say, wow, she was my coach.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Martin Rooney, who is the author of a book called Coach to Coach, an empowering story about how to be a great leader. This is a book about coaching, and we'll talk in a moment about kind of the framework around which this book is created. But it is designed to help all of us think about what it means to be an effective coach. And it also is intended to kind of broaden our horizons in terms of understanding who coaches and in what situations and scenarios. And I really love this from the introduction. You kind of quoted a part of it yourself already when you said, I believe being called coach is the most honorable title you can earn. When someone calls you coach, he or she is handing you the reins to some aspect of their life. So for instance, when a young person has me as their voice teacher, they are handing me the reins pretty much when it comes to their singing voice and the repertoire they will choose and the formation of their technique, they are entrusting that gift to me. And likewise, in all kinds of other avenues of life, we will find ourselves, in a sense, entrusted with helping somebody else in this way that you think we should think of as coaching.
Yeah, I couldn't say it better right there, which, you know, was some of the intro too. But yeah, you see, what I would say right there, Greg, is if someone else read it and said a very similar thing, I would say, now you get it. Now you get it that look at the responsibility and the authority that comes along with that word coach, where when I say, hey, I'm not saying being an accountant is not important. I'm not saying, or here would be a great one that I've talked about recently too, is we heard this word essential, right? Like, hey, these are our essential workers. And I can remember talking to people in my Training for Warriors network, and they were upset where they said, wait a minute, does this mean we're not essential because our gyms can't be open, or I'm not essential because I'm not either working at a bank or a grocery store? And I want, you know, everybody listening, hey, guys, everybody's essential to someone else. And without a doubt, we are essential because we are someone else's coach. And, a great way to describe the book or the genesis behind it was when I went to the Medical University of South Carolina, the first thing they had us learn was the Hippocratic Oath. And many people are familiar, at least with a shortened version of it. It's actually much longer. But people will say, oh, the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm. And yeah, that's an incredible summary of it. And what it essentially means is, hey, you're going to be a doctor. If you're going to be a doctor, man, your job, you can never forget. It's so important. But make sure under this role, you don't make anybody worse. Like, at least make them better.
Exactly.
What I said was, but think about now when you become a coach. When you become a coach, there is no Hippocratic Oath. And what I said is, this book should be the Hippocratic Oath for coaching, so that when somebody reads it and they say, wow, I'm a coach now, holy cow, I got to make sure I don't make anybody worse, and I got to make sure I understand the role. And this book was the offering to do that. And somebody, a great author and friend of mine, Jeffrey Gittimer, who has one of the greatest business-selling books of all time, wrote me the other day, and he said, this book, you know what it is? It gets people to be more hippocratical instead of being hypocritical. And I just loved that when he got that from the book.
By the way, I want to give you a second to explain the dedication to the book. And I think maybe you've already mentioned this gentleman's name once before. I think you said he was your middle school and high school track coach. So he helped you to achieve greatness in the javelin throw, among other things. So you dedicate the book to my old coach, Bill Scarola, who taught me you must first be on fire before you can make someone else burn. I really like those words, and those get right at the heart of what this book's about.
Yeah, well, hey, my coach Scarola, and here's an interesting thing. We still talk to this day. I just talked to him last week, and and this is pretty heartwarming. You might like this that goes with the book, because this is the stuff people can't see, is that I didn't tell him I wrote the book, and I didn't tell him I dedicated it to him, but I sent him a copy, and I have a voice message on my phone, and I still saved it, and I'll always save it, and it's him calling, and he's just crying, and he can't even really get the words out, because he had just finished the book, and it was so powerful. And ultimately, when he was able to compose himself and we talked afterwards, he was just so happy, because after his 40 years of coaching, he's retired now, he really realized with that gift that it mattered what he did. You know, and I think that's what we all will question at the end of our lives, right? Like, did I make a difference? What is my legacy? How did I make the world a little bit better than before I got here? And I think this was even his big reminder, being such a great coach as he was, that that's like, man, that's another great gift that a coach gets, is by having the reins of some aspect of somebody's life, you can really do something incredible. You can do something so great. And man, it was, you know, so he was the guy that found me when I was very young. I thought I was going to be a baseball player. The story is actually inside the book, but through the characters, not through me. And, man, I didn't make the baseball team because I was too young. And there he was, standing outside the door with all the kids that had not made that team and was telling them they looked perfect for track. And they kept saying, he kept saying, you look perfect for track. You look perfect for track. And I got to admit, at that age, the last thing I felt was perfect at anything. But I looked up at him at night, and I saw his enthusiasm, and I said, the only thing I thought I could say, I said, track? And he goes, yeah, yeah, kid. And I said, what's that? You know, what's track? And he ended up, man, the next day I joined track, and 5 or 6 years later he had just changed my life and what I believed I could do and who I could be. And again, he showed me that I wanted to be that kind of person for somebody else someday too. And he was my real inspiration to be a coach.
So let's have you explain the framework of this particular book that that you have created, kind of the scenario, kind of a fictional scenario within which then you're able to kind of impart some wisdom on what coaching is all about. You have created the character of a one Brian Knight. Tell us about him and tell us about the process of creating him. I mean, the kind of things tell us about the kind of things you thought about in terms of shaping who he was, especially at the outset of this book.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, everybody was always saying, you got to write a book. You got to write a book, which I hope you can appreciate. That would be like me saying, hey, Greg, you got to compose a symphony. You know, just go do that. You know, and so it's not, you know, so anybody that ever says to somebody, go write a book, it's a lot harder than it sounds. But I have written a number of other books, and this was a departure for me. I knew with coaching, I couldn't write a workbook or a textbook. It would be too dry, and it would be impossible to encompass things that would work for everyone. And what I realized was what people always enjoyed about my coaching was my storytelling. So I said, what if I write a story with stories within the story to really teach people the importance about being a coach? And then that, saying that to myself, made the work even harder, because to really learn how to write in conversation and as you already mentioned, to create characters and have these characters converse but still get the points across that you wanted, man, it was a lot tougher than I originally imagined. But the genesis for the book, and again, it's a parable, it's a story. And if anybody listening has ever read any books by John Gordon or Mitch Albom or Patrick Lencioni from the business world, and my publisher is the same as John Gordon's and Lencioni's, then you understand that kind of parable story. Or another great name is Ken Blanchard as well. And so I wrote it in the vein of that style, which I always love to read those books. And I said, well, how is it going to work? And that is when the idea of coach to coach came to me, where every coach, right, if we're going to agree today that everyone is a coach, well, when somebody teaches you something, they're the older coach, you're the young coach, and they pass it on to you, and then your job is to eventually pass it on to someone else. And everything throughout history travels from coach to coach. And so I said, I want to have a young coach, and I modeled him after when I was much younger, say about 27. I had just had my first couple of kids. I'm embarking on this career, but I don't know what I'm doing. And then I said, now imagine me at 50 or me at 60, and what would I say? Who would I be, and what would I say and come back if I could to help that kid, right? And that was kind of the inspiration behind the book. And it was almost as if to deliver 30 or 40 years of wisdom to this younger coach that isn't getting things right. And to be clear for everybody that reads it, it's not just about sports. Brian is having trouble with his wife. He's not spending enough time with his children. He's not connecting with his players or his other coaches. And it's almost, you get this 360-degree view of his life and how coaching permeates all of it. And I'll tell you, women have written me, and the story has just connected with them so strongly. And so this isn't a book for men. It's not a book just for women. It's a book for everyone. And if you love a great story, when I had to get testimonials, Coach Lou Holtz and Dan Gable, these famous coaches, got on board. But then I got Sean Johnson, who loved it, who was America's Sweetheart, and won Dances with the Stars. But the one I think I'm most proud of is Rudy Rudiger from the movie Rudy. Said he thought it was a great football story. And, I took that one to heart because, man, his story is one of the greatest football stories ever.
Absolutely.
But ultimately, the genesis was I wanted to create a challenge because that's what great stories are about is hero meets great challenge and hero figures out how to overcome it with a coach. Think about it. That's Rocky. That's, it's Jaws. It's any great story. That's what happens. And I wrote my own version. It took a really long time. But the great news is I sent it in with no agent, no editor. And, man, Wiley picked it up in one day and said, this is the best one we've read in a long time. We got to have it. And it after all that work, it launched last month when we were all pushed into our homes. But I could not have predicted how important the message would be for everybody right now.
Right. One of the hallmarks of this older coach's advice to Brian Knight has to do with enthusiasm, and that success is so rooted to our own enthusiasm. And the way one sort of finds your own primary source of enthusiasm is really essential in this. And as we read the story, we really come to understand how easy it is to lose track of that, to lose connection with whatever that one essential thing is about which you can be the most enthusiastic.
It is not only the central part of the book, but I think the central part of people's lives. For instance, you've already mentioned, piano and music. Well, I guarantee you were enthusiastic about it or you would have never pursued it. And you did pursue it where many people might have lost sight or said, piano or voice, that isn't real. And then they go and do something else, which would be the biggest tragedy. But right now, as I'm describing it, Greg, is I've called this time, yes, it's been one of our greatest challenges where we're fighting a common enemy for the first time in history, but it's also been a gift where if people haven't realized what they really love to do or what they're enthusiastic about or hasn't revealed to them what are the most important things in their lives again, then I don't know what time will. And I'll tell you, from not only my connection to my family but also my passions again by showing me what I really miss the most, it has I think when we come out of this, it's going to make a lot of people stronger and give them the courage to pursue those enthusiasms versus continue their lives doing something that they don't love. And I definitely hope that the book inspires people about that too.
I want to give you just a quick chance to talk about one of the bits of advice that this older coach gives, which is about that often when we are misfiring or having trouble, it has to do with aiming at the wrong target, and that carefully thinking about what our target needs to be is often one of the most valuable things that we can that we can do, or one of the most valuable adjustments that we can make. Just explain what that is about.
Yeah, well, and hey, for everybody listening, Greg has read this book because he is pulling out the best stuff. And Greg, you know what I regret right now? You should have. Your voice is so great. You should have read the book on audio. I know your listeners have to appreciate that. Where man, this has been like the most enjoyable interview just to listen to you talk about my book.
thanks.
But for targeting, what I talk about is so many people, they say what they want in life, but they don't spend any time doing the things that they should do to make that happen. And I kind of call that targeting. And in the book, I use an example, and it's a classic where it's about an archer. And the archer is about to perhaps win this big competition. And he shoots the target dead solid perfect, but he loses as a result. And the reason he lost is because he shot the wrong target. And I use that as an example of most people in their lives do the same thing. I'll meet people that say, oh, I want to be more fit. Everybody tells me they want to be more fit, but then they're targeting at Netflix or the internet, and they just sit there all day doing that instead, or they eat the wrong foods, which is the wrong target. Or people will tell me, I want to make more money. And then I'll say, okay, well, where are you spending your time? And they're spending it on things that have no value and don't generate any more money. So the challenge in the book for the reader is to identify, what are you targeting at right now? Like, where are you spending your time? And does that align with your greater goals or your passions? And if it doesn't, then you got to change and hit the right target.
Right. You know, that reminds me of another favorite moment in the book when you have the old coach telling the younger coach that a coach spells the word care. When we say that we care about something, you spell the word care, T-I-M-E. And, of course, that goes for a young athlete. I mean, if they're willing to put in the time, or a young singer, if they're willing to practice, or a parent willing to spend some of their off hours, you know, with their kids, even if it's something that isn't particularly interesting. But, I mean, you do that if you really care. I mean, that is how you demonstrate that you care about someone or something. And that there is so much wrapped up in those simple words that we all need to take to heart.
Yeah. Well, and right now, time is the one thing that many of us have more of than ever. And again, it's a gift where so many people, Greg, used to tell me, oh, I don't have time to work out. I don't have time to spend with my family. I don't have time to eat well. And this was always due to the rat race of life. And what's interesting is now a lot of that has been removed, or at least it has for the last couple of months for all of us. And I don't know. I talk to so many people that, well, they still didn't do it, even when they got the time. And that's when it showed it wasn't a time problem. Maybe it was a discipline problem or an enthusiasm problem. But a lot of times, going back to what we talked about, it was just a targeting problem.
Yeah.
So the targeting and time, they go together, where it's kind of like when you're saying, am I spending my time on the right target? And right now, just as some advice for everybody in their homes, I've already told you, you're coaches now, and you're a coach to yourself, and you're a coach to your family. And I'm hoping that this interview inspires everybody to make sure they spend time on the right target.
Hmm.
And if that happens, you know, and that's what the purpose of the book was, too. And if even just something as simple as that happened, and a parent spent more time with their child and unveiled their passion to them and helped them to pursue it, the book will have done its job 10 times over.
Hmm. The book is Coach to Coach, an empowering story about how to be a great leader, published by Wiley, the author Martin Rooney. Martin Rooney, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your great book, and best wishes.
My pleasure.
And the time is 8:59 here on WGTD. Again, we apologize for the mix-up in our files. And what was originally scheduled for today's morning show is going to be airing on Monday. And that will be Nan Calvert in her monthly visit to the program, and joining her, Kevin Doyle, a rare plant botanist with the Department of Natural Resources. And we'll find out about endangered plants. And it's a really interesting interview. We recorded it yesterday morning, and I learned a lot, and I think you will too. And so that's going to be Monday now on The Morning Show. Tomorrow on The Morning Show podcast, from the archives, Mara Gibbs and a wonderful book called Everybody Eats There, Inside the World's Legendary Restaurant.